Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 12, Episode 8. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of author Mark Towsey. Tonight, you'll hear tales of unwanted deliveries, treasures too good to pass up, rooftop chats, and insectus interruptus. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Most of us have probably returned to shopping, as usual. But for some people, home deliveries have become as much a part of their life as anything else. But beware, because you never know who will show up on your doorstep, or what. Without further ado, I present to you Convenience Shopping. This is unacceptable. Over 2 hours late now. Tardiness is one thing that drives me nuts, especially when all I have in the fridge are a few bits of dried-up celery and some out-of-date hummus. Someone is going to pay. Window frames rattle, rain pounds against the tarmac, and it all adds up to my frustration as I shuffle across the carpet, arms folded in silent protest. This bloody weather's unacceptable. For 3 goddamn weeks, we've had this rain and wind, and as soon as I open the door to the pesky delivery guy, winter will steal all the warmth from the house. What's his name? Brian? Yeah, nice enough for a menial worker, but it took me ages to clean all the muddy footprints he traipsed down the hallway last time. Hell, if I'm getting a drenching, though. For Christ's sakes, where are you, Brian? The sooner you're finished, the sooner you can return to your cheap-ass beer and lousy American sitcoms. This is absolutely unacceptable. I grasp the phone, knuckles turning white. Hello, yes? I'm waiting for a delivery. Number 16, Alpaca Crescent. Due 2 hours ago? Yes, I know there's water on the roads. Why, is he coming by boat? Don't put me on hold, don't you? Bitch! My jaw clicks back into place. I must have been grinding my teeth again. What? Still 3 more ahead of me? Well, what time will that be? Oh, for Pete's sake. Next week, a new supermarket opens on the other estate. I might give those a try if they deliver. Christ, I might even be desperate enough to drive to the store myself, if not. Just the thought of it, though, makes my skin crawl. Breathing in the same oxygen as all the bumbling day creatures. But it's even worse after dusk, a more terrifying breed of people coming out of the woodwork. Drive to the store myself? Oh, here I go again. Who am I trying to kid? Anxiety turns my stomach as my eyes fall and the letters on the sideboard that need to go to number 19. They've been there days now, and I can't bring myself to march just a couple of doors down and stick them in his mailbox. Someone might see me and attempt to engage in conversation. Thought of it. Even worse, what if he came out? John, the guy's name, according to the letters. Stupid mailman. I made the mistake of feeling brave one night, wheeling the bins out before midnight. Caught him, John, staring at me from underneath the streetlight. He eyed me up and down from head to toe and back again. Give me the chills. Do what you like behind closed doors is my motto, though. The motto of any agoraphobic, I guess. I've become even more insulated since they let me work from home. Wouldn't have it any other way, though. Hate people. Hate them all. Floating around in their bubbles of superficiality, bouncing their negative energy from one to the next. The doctor said you never really do get over it. Agoraphobia, that is. I made the joke once that coming out about it would surely help. He gave me a prescription in the name of a specialist that doesn't do house visits. Prick. If I don't go out, I don't need the medication. There are other things on the list, too, but I chose to ignore them one at a time, happy enough in my own little world. An engine. That's definitely an engine. Arms still folded, hairs bristling on my neck. I march to the living room window and peer through the blurry raindrops. I see a van turning the corner, but it's different from the one that usually comes. Just white, no shop logo. Perhaps the main van broke down and that's why they're running late. I don't like change. It's on the list. Thrumming my fingers against my windowsill, I watch the driver pull up outside. I don't think it's Brian. My fingers tingle and my stomach churns in that familiar way. This is not acceptable. The door opens and he's gone. Palms sweaty, I hold my breath and wait for him to reappear. There he is, dressed in jeans, a gigantic leather jacket, and glasses so dark I wonder how he can see anything. Christ, he's built like a brick shithouse. His huge balloon hands begin working at the locks. Oh, this is no good at all. I could pretend to be out, but I'm so hungry. And besides, the car is parked in the driveway. The ramp goes down, and the jacket, effortlessly, begins dragging the dolly trolley down. I miss Brian and his normal-sized shoes. The feet on this guy must be world record territory. What do I say to him? Hi, man. How's it hanging? Nice shades? Who'd you kill today? He's halfway down the ramp. I step away from the window and hover in the archway, biting at my cuticle, swallowing down the metallic offering. Blood pulsates in my ears as I wait for the inevitable knock. There it is, and as predicted, it feels like a hammer to my brain. I take a deep breath, wrapping my fingers around the cold handle. I'll tell him to leave the bags there. I'll sign and he'll be on his way. Rather get soaked than let this thug into my house. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Before I can open my mouth, Jacket pushes by, dragging the dolly trolley over the sacred threshold and lurching towards my kitchen, a trail of red in his wake. What the... I open my mouth, but close it again, noting only a tiny tap between his shoulders and the hallway walls as I sheepishly follow. The meat. It must have already defrosted because it's so late. This is not acceptable. He pushes the paperwork at me without even a grunt. No apology, nothing. Right, that's it. I'm furious. Heads will roll. I sign the docket and hand it back to him with a smile. Where's Brian? Not sure. I'm just filling in today. He shrugs and unpacks the bags onto the kitchen table, splashing more blood over the upholstered chairs and checkered towels. All that meat's probably already ruined. It even smells off. I fumble the phone from my pocket, intending to take a photograph and attach it as evidence to a very snotty email that I'll write as soon as Jacket leaves. Someone is going to pay for this cock-up. If I can just get a shot with the delivery guy in it so they can't worm their way out of it, claiming sabotage. Hovering over the nearest bag, I take my chance and discreetly pull the plastic to one side. The explosion of vomit is instant. I reach for the counter, heaving up seamlessly endless amounts of stringy celery onto tiles I'd only cleaned this morning. As the image of human feet tied up with string embeds itself in my mind for eternity, one thought repeats in my head. This is not acceptable. Something wrong? A gruff voice comments from behind. I retch again, but only a watery green liquid emerges, and I spit as much of it out as possible. I think there's been a mistake, I finally croak. As I straighten myself, trying to regain some semblance of composure, the guy raises an eyebrow and begins checking through the docket. Trying to stop the room from spinning, I focus on a droplet of rain, making its way down his impossibly round head towards the inch-long scar above his right eyebrow. It doesn't help. The size of the guy's arms makes the full-to-the-brim plastic bag tucked under it look like his marble collection. As he licks his thumb and turns the page, one of the spherical-shaped objects drops to the floor. It doesn't bounce or roll. It simply lands with a softness that sends a shudder down my aching spine. It's looking at me. It's looking at me. Against the starkness of the white tile, I study the eyeball, a network of red veins threading across the white but running short of the purity surrounding the green. It reminds me of an unlit neon sign. But it's not. It's an eyeball. A bloody eyeball. Reality kicks in and I take a step back, my heart thumping against its cage. My legs feel weak and unstable, and I'm half surprised they still work. At least three eyes are looking at me. Two behind Jacket's large black shades, one at his feet. Goodness knows how many more in the bag. And the feet in the bag? What is? No, it's all here, the man comments. I already checked it twice before I left. A bead of blood runs from his right nostril toward his lip. There's a giant in my kitchen and an eyeball on my floor. Cool lyrics, but what's happening here? Is this a panic attack? Is my mind playing tricks, some Alice in Wonderland on crack scenario? Time to get the medication topped up. A sharp pain runs up my spine as I connect with the kitchen counter. Coiling my fingers around the benchtop, I cling on for dear life, but I really want to get off this bloody ride now. Your nose. He puts the bag down and slakes a thick arm across his face. Hello, someone sings from the hallway. Who is this, the White Rabbit? I hear the wiping of feet and the click of the door. Come in, then. Jacket's head snaps around, and he immediately starts moving the bags under the table. Get rid of them quickly, he says. But I can't move. My legs have finally checked out. Besides, the uninvited guest is already thundering down the hallway. This is unacceptable. Footsteps close in, I hold my breath. John? It's John from number 19. What the? Your door was open. Both Jacket and I look towards him, following his eyes to the floor, to the eye on the floor. There's a rusty number 6 in his left hand, and I recognize it as the one from my mailbox. In his right hand are the letters, his letters, the ones from the sideboard. I think there's been a mix-up, he says. Jacket looks back towards me and back at John. John looks towards me and back at the eyeball on the floor. Is this not number 19? Jacket finally comments. John sighs. Not a nonchalant sigh. It carries weight and adds a heaviness to the already unbearable tension. Pinching the weathered base between his index finger and thumb, he lifts the number towards Jacket, displaying it as a 9, but letting it slide into the intended 6. blasted weather causing havoc, he says, tossing it on top of the bag of feet. Why is everybody so calm when there's an eye on the floor? The eye, is all I can manage to say. John tugs at his pants and crouches to the floor. He picks up the eyeball and holds it out in front of him, as he did with the rusty number, just as casually. He rolls it between his fingers and holds it to his nose, offering a sharp sniff. No, no way he just did that. John puts the eyeball into his mouth. As he began to chew, my grip tightens on the benchtop. I retch into my bonsai. But there's nothing left to emerge. I can hear it crunching between his teeth and can imagine the gooey content slipping into the back of his throat. This is not acceptable. John stands, looks me over, and turns his glance back to Jacket. Where's my regular guy? Sick. I'm on meat, usually. This is not acceptable, he says. I want more than a club discount after this. I want nothing more than to be outside, breathing in the fresh air now. Hands on his hips, John stares at where the eye used to be, finally offering another nonchalant sigh and a shake of his head. Can't get the staff these days. He slowly lifts his head, exposing a bead of magnificent red running from his nose over his top lip. His tongue slides across to collect as he looks me up and down, just like he did under the streetlight. I've got a plastic sheet in the van, Jacket says, and my tools. John nods without taking his glance from mine. Fresh is best. I hope you enjoyed Convenient Shopping by Mark Towsey, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Towsey. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/TOWSE. If you like the stories you've heard, find many more in anthologies, his own collections, or even a standalone book or two. Visit his works on Instagram, WordPress, or Amazon. If you do decide to stop by the profile, please leave him a kind word and let him know you heard about him here on this show and that me, Otis Jerry, sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. Just a reminder to you, when someone says, hide the eyeball, make sure you hide the eyeball. It's just courtesy. Hey, do you recall sticker books? I actually have a few up on my shelf. It was always so much fun trading with friends to get stickers I didn't already have. And if they didn't want to trade, I had ways to be very persuasive. But there's always the line you have to draw with how far you're willing to go to complete a collection. Some kids will just step over that line. Without further ado, I present to you Golden Child. England, late October, 1986. He's got him, he's sure of it, the feet in his eyes. You know you want to, Smithy, come on. Just don't know, Charlie. It's a good deal, but do it then. Don't think about it. Thinking's for broken-hearted. Smithy shakes his head and creases his forehead. Huh? Never mind. It seemed like a good play at the time. A line from one of his mom's favorite songs, but he needs to get the boy nodding, not shaking. Josh looks at his watch again. They've been at it for nearly 50 minutes and don't seem any closer. Come on, guys, I gotta get home for tea. Shut up, Josh, Charlie snaps. We're negotiating. Jeez, all right. Josh buries his chin into his neck. They're only stickers. Charlie readies himself to unleash at his friend, but thinks better of it. You're right. You're absolutely right, Josh. See, Smithy, they're only stickers. And look, you're getting six of mine for one of yours. He holds the glossy cards up like a 10-pound note and wafts them in his face. Just think how much closer you'll be to filling the book. Yeah, but mine's silver, Smithy says, shifting his glance to his own watch. Don't mean squat. There are as many out there as there are of the others. It's just a myth. Too much, damn it. His dad said it's okay to skew the truth, but never offer an outright lie. He sold 40 cars last month, so he knows what he's talking about. Smithy offers another shake of his head. Mom's doing lasagna for tea. I'd best be getting home. She can wait. Both Smithy and Josh snap their heads towards Charlie, and an awkward silence blankets the corner of the small playground. Calm, Charlie, calm. Smithy, this is just about you and me. The planets have aligned so that we can do this deal. I don't know, Charlie. I'm only asking for Tunnel Stalker. It's a silver, though. Charlie feels the deal slipping away. It's time to go for broke. Pull out all the stops. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Smithy, how are you ever going to get through life without making a decision? The kid shrugs. Smithy, this is a big moment. Coming of age thing, and to tell you the truth, you're cocking it up. Josh does a 180 and kicks a tuft of grass, starting to feel bad for the kid. Did you decide what to have for breakfast this morning? Charlie says, leaning in. Smithy nods. Did you decide where to sit on the school bus this morning? Smithy nods again. Did you decide what underwear you'd wear today? Smithy shrugs. Oh, Jesus. Charlie reaches a hand to the kid's shoulder. Two out of three ain't bad, but three out of four sounds better. What do you say, kid? I'll sleep on it, Charlie. Talk to me tomorrow. Tomorrow? Tomorrow the planets fall out of the sky, Smithy. Tomorrow might never come. Tomorrow's nearly here, Josh says, but regrets it instantly, as he feels the sting against his neck. The acorn lands near his feet, and he boots it into the damp grass. Tomorrow, Charlie. Smithy gets up and slips the precious silver card back into the front sleeve of his album. I gotta go. All right then, you prick. He watches the kid make his way to the other end of the playground, album carefully tucked under his right arm. Other people want these, though. You'll live to regret this, Smithy. Mark my words, Josh mumbles under his breath. Thought you had him there, Charlie. Maybe you're losing your touch. That was your fault, Charlie says, pushing himself up from the gravel and giving his pants an angry rush down. How'd you make that out? I got to get home for tea, Charlie mimics in a less than favorable voice. You think Richard Branson ever said that? Well, sorry, guys. I've got to put this billion-dollar deal on ice because my chips are burning. I guess not, Charlie. But I'm sure Richard Branson picks out his own underwear. Yeah, good point. He slides the cards carefully back into the little plastic wallet and into the album's inside sleeve. God damn it. Only three more and the book's full. The pair begin making their way across the field toward Spencer Road, breathing in the scent of earthy mud and thinking about all the useless ways they can fill their evening. Jono only needs two silvers. I can't let him beat me, Josh. Man, you're obsessed. I haven't seen you this excitable since Amy Winters asked to stroke your dog. Yeah, I'm a hot dog. They laugh until they have tears in their eyes, setting each other off again as they approach composure. Charlie even momentarily forgetting about the two silvers and gold. Only the sight of Richard Hawkins and crew near the corner shop throws a heavy blanket on their fire. Charlie stops dead, hoping they haven't seen him already. Why does he hate you? He hates everyone, just me that little bit more. Charlie edges away, taking cover behind a large oak and driving his back against the bark. Can't go that way, Josh. No way. If he gets hold of my stickers... Mate, I have to get back. I'm already on a warning. If he asks, tell him I'm already at home, yeah? I knew it was a bad idea, bringing him with me. Of course, Charlie. It's a hell of a long way around, though, isn't it? Just go, Josh. From where they're standing, you're talking to a tree. Okay, it's cool. I'll see you tomorrow, yeah? Yeah, just go. Charlie gives it a few seconds before sticking his head out to see Josh approaching the road, head down, not running, but as good as. He hears one of the crew, possibly Richard himself, holler something, but traffic swallows any further exchange. For what seems like an eternity, he waits for them to leave, praying he won't need to go through Thorny Passage under the old railway tunnel line. Finally through the field with the scarecrow and decrepit barn. Those types of experiences are for sharing, a ritual that conjures brave talking, but also elevated heart rates and skin that crawls. But he's kidding himself. Those kids have nowhere to go, never will. You've got this, Charlie. He scoots behind the cover of the next tree. Hate you, Smithy. Another peek, but they're still smoking statues. Contemplates just waiting it out, but on the occasions when his dad forces him to help with food shopping, he's seen them there well past 7. His stomach stirs as he takes in a few breaths of earthiness mixed with cooking food. He'll be at least 30 minutes late, no silver card, and a whole heap of trouble from his parents. 3, 2, 1. The marshy ground gives underneath as he makes his run, backpack swinging wildly behind, sticker album tucked tightly under his right arm. He glances to the right, but so far so good. Thorny Passage awaits only 30 yards ahead, but if they see him now, there's a good chance they'll follow, and that'll take things up a notch. Come on! Thoughts of the upcoming ordeal plague his mind, so he begins envisaging the blank spaces in his album to counteract. Tunnel Stalker, Mole Man, and Swamp Thing are all that stands between him and notoriety among his peers. Tunnel Stalker. It had to be, didn't it? Another glance to his right shows the crew is none the wiser. He slows his pace to a jog as he approaches the gravelly path, spiky tendrils like barbed wire fencing looming on the other side, along with the faded poster of the missing kid attached to the lamppost. He takes cover, turning to his side, ready to shimmy through. Please leave. Please leave. A last hopeful glance across, the realization dawns that he has no choice. Trying to avoid eye contact with the poor kid's face in the poster, he shakes off the backpack, unzips it, and carefully slides the album in. Okay. Holding the pack tight to his chest, he breathes in and begins to sidestep, screwing up his face as thorns start pulling at his clothes and skin. A distant holler snaps his head around, and his stomach drops. Blood pounds in his ears as he holds his breath, but no voices. He carries on, shrugging off the spiky attackers and pulling the pack even tighter to his chest. Bloody Smithy, bloody Josh. He misses his best friend already, though, each step taking him further into the bowels of the thorny beast. Ducking and weaving as best he can, the prickly vines seem intent on claiming him, and frustration finally sets in as his right foot gets tangled, quickly turning to pressure behind his eyes as he rips it away, catching the side of his cheek with a good one. Traces the wound with an index finger of his right hand and inspects the magnificent red against his paleness. Finally, bringing it to his lips, he finds himself wondering if he even took the right opening. If one day someone might stumble upon his remains, thorny tendrils emerging from his eye holes of his skull. Hell, Charlie, get a grip. But he remains on the verge of tears until, through a gap in the thorns, he catches sight of the embankment and the rusty roof of the old makeshift station. The last of the vines latches onto his jumper, but he tears away easily and throws the backpack a across his shoulder, ready for stage two, the climb. He takes a breath and begins his ascent. Tufts of wet grass and the occasional clump of damp brown leaves, making for a challenging scramble. But momentum carries him forward, that and the urgency to get home. Finally, at the top, he affords himself a few gulps of leafy air. No going back now, Charlie. He thinks about form class on Thursday morning, and how well his story of bravery will go down, how he took the shady road home just for the hell of it. A gust of cool wind highlights the evidence on his face, and serves as a prompt for him to stop crapping and get cracking. Tunnel next. Okay, let's do this. He lowers himself to the grassy decline, extends his toes and digs his heels into the ground, shuffling his bum across a few inches at a time. It's a perfect system until his palm finds a semi-crusted pile of white dog crap hiding in a flurry of tall grass. He can hear Josh's laughter in his head. What are the chances? He'd say, or something along those lines. It's a bittersweet feeling as Charlie wipes his hand on the grass. Dog poo. Dogs. He thinks about their German shepherd, Basil, waiting patiently at the window for his return. Easing himself down the rest of the hill, he notes how ominous the tunnel looks in the distance. Strangely longer, too, as if it's grown recently, along with the vegetation. No going back. He surveys the disused railway line. A case of nature meets humans, and nature's winning. Long grasses and vines work through the gravel and spill over the rusty frames of the tracks, even beginning to swallow the brickwork of the tunnel ahead. So damn dark in there. He sets off, the urge to cry gone, but the hairs on his neck bristling their warning. The low sun causes him to squint on the approach, but he still notices the abundance of rabbits scampering and fleeing back to their homes. Stranger danger. He raises an arm as a glare worsens, but not before he catches sight of something glimmering in the tunnel's depths. Gone just as quick, though. What was that? Arching his neck, he searches again, but only finds fluffy gray floaters as the sun's rays hit him full on. Another chilly gust blows across as he squelches his eyes with the ball of his right hand. Temperature's dropping. Thoughts of being out here without sunlight spur him back into action, and he begins to jog toward the tunnel's opening. The plan is to sprint right through. Not overly complex, but at least it's a plan. He guesses he can do it in 20 seconds, tops. 20 seconds, Charlie. That's nothing. He reaches an arm out toward the brick and performs a futile series of stretches, noting the graffiti scrawled across the entrance. For a good time, Carl Charlie Davenport's mom. That bastard. He guesses the handiwork of Richard and his minions. Wrong number, still. Mid-limber, it catches his eye again, something on the floor, just on the border of where dark meets light. He'll stick to the right, away from oblivion. Three. A couple of deep breaths of earthy dampness, mixed with a tinge of stale urine. Two. He yanks a leg behind his back, just like on his mom's aerobic videos. One. And he's off, arms and legs going like the clappers, and as close to the tunnel wall as he can get without being part of it. Coldness wraps around him, and the putrid cocktail on entry fades to something much worse. Something he'll try and forget as soon as light washes over him. He hears gravel crunching under his shoes, but he can't feel his legs. Darkness seems to be spilling towards him from the sides with each step, and what was that? He snaps his head to the left. Only a dark void awaits. Cold air stings his lungs as his arms swing by his side, more of a desperate clawing at the air than good form, as if trying to grab onto an invisible rope. Another glimmer. No, no way. He draws closer, a second wind, teeth digging into his lip, heart feeling dangerously close to exploding. There's just no way. But it's not a trick of the light after all. A silver. Over the pounding blood in his ears and the clunk of steel, as he dances across one of the rails, he thinks he hears a noise from behind, but a glance over his shoulder only finds unlit recesses. He snaps his head back around, eyes on the prize, but still unable to make it out. Preparing for collection, he stoops, knowing the odds are. Tunnel Stalker. Long and gangly limbs, skin almost translucent against contrastingly stringy black hair, and menacing eyes. He knows the creature off by heart. He's envisioned the card so many times, as if he could somehow conjure it from thin air. With fingers stretched out, he lowers his arm to the ground, grimacing as he catches the sharpness of gravel, but not recoiling. And strike! His fingers catch the edge, but he fumbles it, only managing to flick it over. He turns sharply, pushing his right foot against the semi-exposed wood. Was that gravel crunching? Something moves within, too, a shadow in a shadow. He saw it. He's sure of it. Ah, your imagination, Charlie. Suck it up. There is an expelling of air as if someone is breathing. It's just in your head, Charlie. He wants to turn and sprint for the light, but knows he'll burst with regret when he gets home. Silver. Only two more after that. Before he can talk himself out of it, he thrusts himself into darkness and swoops in again, focusing on the card and nothing else, ignoring the sounds that aren't really there, as he's the only one in the goddamn tunnel. Gravel crunches, something breathes. It's you, Charlie, you idiot. His fingers meet glossiness and clamp down like a crocodile's bite. Another rasp, more grinding gravel. With a garbled war cry, he makes his run, almost toppling over. But momentum and sheer will somehow keep him up. He hears someone calling his name from behind. The voice raspy, rattly, the stuff of nightmares. Charlie Davenport! The feeling on his legs is back, but they only scream at him to stop as his feet fall heavier with each step. So close, he can almost feel the sunlight on his face. It's in my head! It's in my head! What about the breathing you saw? Something move? A rat? It must be a big sucker. Light falls golden ahead, and it's a heavenly sight. Home stretch. Gritting his teeth, he sprints for his life, all technique out the window, limbs jerking like a marionette on speed. In my head. Gravel crunches, something hot falls across his neck. I'm doing fish for tea. He glances over his shoulder before letting himself crease over, sucking in urgent mouthfuls of freshness, no longer tainted by, in my head, bad things. The tears are a surprise, but he lets them flow. After all, he's pretty sure nobody's watching. Wisps of breath pepper the air as he shuffles off the backpack and flops through the damp grasses of the embankment. He made it through the tunnel, but his mouth looks less foreboding. Made it, though. Light dances across his sticker as he holds his reward out in front. He angles it left and right, lending animation to the emaciated form of the Tunnel Stalker. The voice plays again in his head. Charlie Davenport. He lets out an involuntary shudder. He pictures Josh's face, the captivated look in his best friend's eyes as he runs through the account of events. Maybe you'll believe him. Well, maybe you won't. But the sticker sure as hell didn't drop from the sky. He takes the album from the pack and begins flickering through the pages, knowing where he'll find a blank space waiting. It feels like a big moment, far more significant than the placement of a card from a purchased pack. He earned this one, put his life on the line. Well, that sounds good in his head. Page 76. He carefully peels off the back layer, inhaling the pungent but gloriously familiar adhesive, and with a shaking hand, brings the silver trophy toward the page. The environment is usually much more controlled for the procedure, and he equates it to surgery. One wrong move, and there's no going back. But luck's on his side today, and it's a perfect placement. Two to go. Conscious of time, he slips the album into his pack and gets to his feet, taking one last prideful look at the conquered tunnel. He gives it the middle finger and turns, beginning his trudge toward Scarecrow Field, the cool breeze accentuating his now damp behind, prompting a quickening of pace. There's undeniable trepidation of what lies ahead, but he's a tunnel beater and has a trophy to prove it. His legs feel springy again, and his heart rate begins to settle close to normal. In my head. A gust of iciness bites at his skin, and he buries his chin into his neck and folds his arms. The further he gets away from the tunnel, the more his mind wanders back to everyday things, like being late home for tea, maths, homework, Amy Winters, and the fact Jono still has the edge, only needing 2 silvers. It's a long wait until pocket money day on Sunday, too. He can already see the kid's smug face as he parades around the school. Look, but don't touch. It'll mean nothing then. All the deals, the extra homework, washing neighborhood cars, watching others chew on impossibly colorful candy, and the goddamn tunnel. All for nothing. He lifts his head to see a speck of a bird resting on top of the fence in the distance, just visible over the slight rise. On the other side of it, he knows the tracks veer off to the left, leading their way to where the next station used to stand. Part of the golf course now, where his dad sometimes plays. Halfway home, Charlie. He ups his tempo as the wind wraps around him. It's getting cold, and he's not dressed for it, his thin jumper offering little protection, and the R's of his half-mast pants wet through. His nose feels like ice as he wipes a string of mucus away. Alternating between a march and a jog, he soon nears the edge of the field and, in the distance, sees the Scarecrow's checkered black and yellow shirt flapping in the breeze, and in behind it, the barn he and Josh joked was full of missing children. His feet finally leave the gravel and begin treading silently on grass that spills through the bottom of the rickety fence. He coils his fingers around the soft wood, surveying the path ahead, squinting into the low light that catches the moisture on the grass. A beautiful sight, if not for the Scarecrow. He plans his route carefully, eyes carving their way down the right side of the field past the ominous figure, and back to the center, away from the pools of brown and that god-awful barn. Halfway, Charlie. The fence gives a little as he straddles it, but he safely drops to the other side, shoes sinking into softness. With a cursory shuffle of his backpack, he sets off, staying close to the fence and trying to avoid the boggier patches that become more abundant with every step. He picks his spots, pointing his shoes like a ballerina 1 minute and taking fairy steps the next, occasionally darting toward the hay-filled monstrosity with gravel for eyes. Paranoia, on this occasion, pays. Hardly able to believe it, he watches it lift against the small rise of grass as another blast of cutting wind rears up. He sees flashing black and yellow from peripheral vision, but his stare remains firmly fixed on the patch of ground 20 yards to his left and just short of a sizable puddle of brown. The wind cuts out, and the card falls back, silver side up. Swamp Thing. Momentarily, he can't move. He just stands there, mouth open, transfixed by the plant-based entity, framed in glorious silver. He tests the ground ahead, soft but no worse than the path trodden so far. Already lowering himself to the ground in preparation, he edges forward again. Nobody's going to believe me. He takes 2 steps, moving stealthily, like a big cat toward its prey. Adrenaline coursing through his veins. Just 1 more card after this. His stomach growls, fear, excitement, hunger, in a perfect storm. Jono's face will be a picture. Nearly within reach, he lets his foot come down, but the ground makes a squelching sound. He tries a different patch, but this time, the brown liquid threatens to spill into his shoe. Just got to rip the bandage off, as his mom says. The thought fills him with sadness and a need to be home. Fish for tea. He readies himself, slapping his thighs, as if to wake up his legs, And as another gust of wind peters out, he makes his move, scrambling forward, grimacing as cold and dirty water finds its way into his shoe. His heavy legs scream at him as he trudges into the murk, up to his ankles now. His left leg forward, and it plunges deep. Right leg forward, and a high-pitched squeal leaves his lips as cold and dirty water settles just below his kneecap. He sees a bubble appear on the surface of the puddle ahead. Desperately, he tries to unplug his left leg, but it's stuck. He throws himself forward, fingers stretched out toward the sticker. But just as they brush against its edge, the wind whistles around him, sending shirt tails flapping and the silver card lifting. The sight of another bubble replacing the last sends him into a frenzy, clawing and pushing at the soft ground, brown water splashing either side. Come on, come on! He manages to rip his left leg free, and he takes the opportunity to reach for the card in the dying gust, continuing his earthworm squirms. Yes! Another bubble emerges on the brown surface, and something has him. Something's latched onto his right foot. Imagination again, Charlie. As his left leg slides redundantly behind in a futile effort to get traction, his hands slop against the mud. A ripple in the water sparks even more aggressive struggling, but it's still locked tight. Something's holding it. That's why, Charlie. He fumbles at the straps of the backpack and swings it to the right, launching his upper half onto it and trying to wiggle loose. Another bubble replaces the last far too quickly for his liking. He closes his eyes and envisages his leg coming free, and it's working. Thrashing his upper body left to right against marshy ground, he continues to inch forward, picturing himself running across the field to the safety of Anderson Road, waking up in a warm bed to the smell of pancakes, only needing one more sticker. He's out. Shoeless, but he's out. Launching his backpack ahead of him a little further each time, he uses it to drag himself as far away from the puddle as possible. It's slow progress, but it's better than having limbs exposed underground. Finally, as he nears the visible footprints, exhausted and covered head to toe in mud, but silver card spotless between his teeth, he scrambles desperately to his feet and begins his run down the right side of the field, legs leaden but still putting up one hell of a fight. He throws his backpack across his shoulders and sniffs back a string of snot that threatens to tarnish his trophy. Feet still squelching but sinking a little less each step, he focuses on a small patch of grass ahead, but well short of the scary barn. Even as he notices movement to his left, probably the wind, he doesn't let himself turn. Even as he hears something akin to splashing, now likely my own damn feet, he keeps his gaze fixed on the circle of grass and his arms pumping. Even as he hears the watery rasp of his name, Charlie Davenport, he doesn't succumb to the temptation for a nervous peek. He runs for his life, doing it justice until his body finally gives up, and he doubles over, chugging on cold air and almost vomiting in the process. In my stupid head. In almost the dead center of the field, standing in his nominated safe zone, chest heaving and the silver card still between his teeth, Charlie turns back toward the large brown puddle to see nothing but his dirt-covered shoe sitting at the edge of its rim. There's no way. There's just no way. But he considers that, in all the chaos, he might just not have seen it come out. He snaps the card from his mouth, lips aching from pinching around the card's glossiness, filled with relief as he's unable to find even a single tooth mark. To be sure, he lifts it to the evening rays, but the blurry white spotlight offers only a bulky mass of green vegetation and black holes for eyes that offer only emptiness. The watery gargle of his name, the splashing, the shoe near the puddle's rim, all in his head. Charlie Davenport. His body offers an exaggerated shudder above and beyond the persistent shivering and he snaps his head toward the puddle. Back to the barn. The puddle. The barn. The puddle. Get a grip, Charlie. He's beyond cold. Clothes heavy with dirt, too. But he can't wait for a second longer. As the grasses give once more to the blast of wind, Charlie presses his palm against the ground of his little haven, and, satisfied he's not going to be sucked arse first into it, takes a seat and unzips his pack. Another sweep of the field, and another, he finally opens the book. Page 32, and he knows it off by heart. And the ritual takes place. Unpeel, sniff, position, place. Swamp Thing, conquered. He lets out a groan as he pushes himself to his feet, zipping the album back into his pack. Every part of him aches, and the chills to his bones, not helped by the ever-increasing wind. But two bloody silvers. One last obstacle, the one with the missing kids chained up inside. It crosses his mind to run, but his legs have other ideas, and he decides to save his energy for when he draws level with the barn. Besides, no danger here. All on your mind, Charlie. He settles to a pace just above normal, his feet finding more solid ground, and as far as he can see, the path getting even clearer ahead. 20 minutes or so, and he'll be home. Late for tea, and inevitably there'll be a scolding. But that's just fine. You'll take it. One more card. Charles' face will melt. As the wind cuts across again, he can hardly feel his fingers, almost translucently white as he holds them out in front. He imagines holding them in front of the fire, and that slightly uncomfortable but welcome tingling as they... No! Sure that his eyes are playing tricks, he follows it to the ground, because there's just no way. Even with his previous finds, even as the card lands on the tuft of grass, face side up, and even as the last of the light shimmers across the brown hairs, he can't bring himself to believe there are only 20 yards between him and Mole Man. He's in the classroom, people climbing over each other to see, oohs and ahs, pats on the back and high fives, Amy Winters with a twinkle in her eye, and in comes Jono, his smile fading to a grimace as realization dawns. Finally, he exhales and begins his approach, skin crawling with excitement, all thoughts of children in the barn fading. 15 yards away, the wind gets up again and the card lifts only slightly. His stomach growls, but he'll be home soon, eating fish and throwing basil, the scraps. Sound of a branch snapping at a foot catches him off guard, but the gold shimmer has him like a tractor beam, and it's only 10 yards from his grasp. His skin prickles as he imagines placing the final sticker in the album and being the envy of the school. He even starts running through a small speech in his head. But just as he gets to the part about the bubbling puddle, the ground begins to give. Shit! His pain explodes in his right leg. He lets out a pain squeal and crumbles to his side, nursing his ankle. Teary eyes fall across the broken branches and tufts of grass that served as his trap. Mole Man resting on top, just slightly out of reach. From deeper into the darkness, Charlie hears breathing and a squeal? In your mind, Charlie. But this time he doesn't buy what he's selling. He gets to his elbows and pushes himself backward, thrusting his legs alternately against the ground. Dim light falls through the opening above, but the dark tunnel ahead swallows most of it. More breathing. With eyes on the solitary star above, he drives back into the wall of mud, offering his cards to the gods in return for his safe passage. It must be nearly 10 feet back to the surface, and no way he could climb back up, even if he wasn't already exhausted and sporting a twisted ankle. Help! His voice is weak, and besides, there's nobody up there. Help! Something's coming. Another high-pitched screech emerges from the depths. Sound of something scraping, too. Please help! He peers into the tunnel, warmth spreading across his thigh as he catches sight of the approaching silhouette. A huge, lumbering mass of darkness, the top of its head almost trailing across the ceiling. Mum's doing fish for tea. He snaps a stare toward the star and offers a final purr, but only gets another squeal for his efforts. It finally comes into view, claws as sharp as knives, carving lines in the muddy wall to its right, long snout twitching at the air in front. Short dark fur covers most of the body. It stands at least 7 feet tall. It has no nose or ears, as far as you can see, but huge eyes as black as space, and an elongated mouth almost as long as the snout that houses rows of razor-sharp teeth. "Shirley Davenport," it squeals. What looks to be a child's backpack, clasped in its left claw. Charlie pushes back against the wall again. "Help!" The creature offers another squeal, and Charlie helplessly watches as it begins sprinkling the contents of the pack on the ground. A small shoe, a hairbrush, a Rubik's Cube, candy bar wrappers, Polaroid camera, and a host of other paraphernalia, most of which look like they once belonged to a kid like you, Charlie. A large book is the last thing to drop, helped by the creature turning the pack inside out as it offers a series of excited squeals. It crouches clumsily, flicking the pages over. "Charlie Davenport. Let me go, please. I'll tell no one. Promise." So many children, perhaps a dozen photographs to each page, and the book so thick. "Please." The tears begin, but he can see clearly enough as the creature flattens the sheet and starts tapping one of its blades in the center of the only golden frame. A light monochrome version of himself smiles proudly from within and beneath in the thick black ink. His name is printed in a strange font full of flicks and curls. "Smile!" The creature squeals, bringing the Polaroid to its face. The camera bathes Charlie in white light, capturing a boy at the height of fear, a kid who knows there'll be no intervention from the gods, no celebration, no fish for tea, no kiss from Amy Winters, no walking basil tonight. As Mole Man wafts the print in the air, squealing with anticipation, Charlie glances at the card sitting atop the branches and grass, his mind full of death, and one crazy thought that he can't shake. At least there was a gold. I hope you enjoyed Golden Child by Mark Kowsey, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed what you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Towsey. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/TOWSE. Find his short works wherever fine anthologies are sold, or follow his social media to find out what he's cooking up next. If you do decide to stop by the profile, please leave a kind word and let him know you heard about him here on this show and that Otis Gyre sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. As a reminder, if you decide to give tonight's talented author's stories a read, please consider leaving him a quality review and a kind word, or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote, and be sure to let him know again that you heard about him here on this program and that Otis sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure that he pretty much would appreciate it as well. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever. wherever else that you listen to your favorite podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. Makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?